Chapter 13. They did not match. No matter how hard Garion twisted and turned the sense of the two passages, there was no apparent way to make them match. Despite the fact that they both seemed to describe the same period of time, they simply went off in opposite directions. It was a bright, golden autumn morning outside, but the dusty library seemed somehow dim, chill, and uninviting. Garion did not think of himself as a scholar, and he had approached the task that Belgarath had laid upon him with some reluctance. The sheer volume of the documents he was obliged to read was intimidating, for one thing, and this gloomy little room with its smell of ancient parchment and mildewed leather bindings always depressed him. He had done unpleasant things before, however, and although he was a bit grim about it, he nonetheless dutifully spent at least 2 hours a day confined in this prison-like cell, struggling with ancient books and scrolls written in oftentimes difficult script. At least, he told himself, it was better than scrubbing pots in the scullery. He set his teeth together and laid the two scrolls side by side on the table, comparing them again. He read slowly and aloud, hoping perhaps to catch with his ears what his eyes might miss. The Darin Codex seemed relatively clear and straightforward. "Behold," it said, "in the day that Aldur's orb burns hot with crimson fire, shall the name of the Child of Dark be revealed. Guard well the son of the Child of Light, for he shall have no brother. And it shall come to pass that those which once were one, and now are two, shall be rejoined, and in that rejoining shall one of them be no more." The orb had turned crimson, and the name of the Child of Dark, Zandramas, had been revealed. That matched what had taken place. The information that the son of the Child of Light, his son, would have no brother had concerned Garion a bit. At first he had taken it to mean that he and Tenedra would only have one child. But the more he thought about that, the more he realized that his reasoning there was flawed. All it really said was that they would only have one son. It said nothing about daughters. The more he thought about it, the more the notion of a whole cluster of chattering little girls gathered about his knee appealed to him. The last passage, however, the one about the two which once were one, did not really make any sense yet, but he was quite certain that it would, eventually. He moved his hand over to trace the lines of the Mrin Codex, peering hard at them in the flickering yellow candlelight. He read slowly and carefully once more. "And the Child of Light shall meet with the Child of Dark, and shall overcome him." That obviously referred to the meeting with Torak. "And the darkness shall flee."
The dark prophecy had fled when Torak had died.
"But behold, the stone which lies at the center of the light,"
the orb, obviously,
"shall..."
One word seemed to be blotted at that point. Garion frowned, trying to make out what word might lie beneath that irregular splotch of ink. Even as he stared at it, a strange kind of weariness came over him, as if the effort to push aside that blot to see what lay beneath were as difficult as moving a mountain. He shrugged and went on.
"And this meeting will come to pass in a place which is no more, and there will the choice be made."
That last fragment had made him want to howl with frustration. How could a meeting, or anything else, happen in a place which is no more? And what was the meaning of the word choice? What choice? Whose choice? Choice between what and what? He swore, then read it again. Once again he felt that peculiar lassitude when his eyes reached the blot on the page. He shrugged it off and went on. No matter what the word under the blot might be, it was still only one word, and one single word could not be that important. Irritably, he put the scroll aside and considered the discrepancy. The most immediate explanation was that this spot, like so many others, was a place where the Mrin Prophet's well-known insanity had simply got the best of him. Another possibility was that his particular copy was not precisely accurate. The scribe who had copied it off had perhaps inadvertently skipped a line or two at the time when he had blotted the page. Geryon recalled an occasion when he had done that himself, turning a perfectly bland proclamation into a horrendous declaration that he was on the verge of naming himself military dictator of all of the kingdoms lying on this side of the eastern escarpment. When he had caught the blunder, he had not just erased the offending lines, he had shudderingly burned the whole sheet to make sure that no one ever saw it. He stood up, stretching to relieve his cramped muscles and going to the small barred window of the library. The autumn sky was a crisp blue. The nights had turned chilly in the past few weeks, and the higher meadows lying above the city were touched with frost when the sun rose. The days, however, were warm and golden. He checked the position of the sun to gauge the time. He had promised to meet with Count Valgon, the Tolnedran ambassador, at midday, and he did not want to be late. Aunt Paul had stressed the importance of punctuality, and Geryon always did his best to be on time. He turned back to the table and absently re-rolled the two scrolls, his mind still wrestling with the problem of the conflicting passages. Then he blew out the candles and left the library, carefully closing the door behind him. Valgon, as always, was tedious. Geryon felt that there was an innate pomposity in the Tolnedran character that made it impossible for them to say what they meant without extensive embellishment. The discussion that day had to do with prioritizing the unloading of merchant vessels in the harbor at the Riva. Valgon seemed terribly fond of the word prioritizing, finding a way to insert it into the discussion at least once in every other sentence. The essence of Valgon's presentation seemed to be a request, or a demand, that Tolnedran merchantmen should always have first access to the somewhat limited wharves at the foot of the city. "My dear Valgon," Geryon began, seeking some diplomatic way to refuse, "I actually believe that this matter needs—" He broke off, looking up as the great carved doors to the throne room swung inward. One of the towering gray-cloaked sentries, who always stood guard outside when Geryon was in the throne room, stepped in, cleared his throat, and announced in a voice that probably could have been heard on the other side of the island, "Her Royal Majesty, Queen Tenedra of Riva, Imperial Princess of the Tolnedran Empire, Commander of the Armies of the West, and beloved wife of His Majesty Belgarion of Riva, Godslayer, Lord of the Western Sea, and Overlord of the West." Tenedra, demure and tiny, entered on the sentry's heels, her shoulders unbowed by the weight of all those vast titles. She wore a teal-green velvet gown, gathered beneath the bodice to conceal her expanding waistline, and her eyes were sparklingly mischievous. Valgon turned and bowed smoothly. Tenedra touched the sentry's arm, strained up on tiptoe and whispered to him. The sentry nodded, turned back toward the throne at the front of the hall, and cleared his throat again. "His Highness, Prince Keldar of Drasnia, nephew of the beloved late King Rhodar, and cousin to King Kiva, Lord of the Marches of the North." Geryon started up from the throne in astonishment. Silk entered grandly. His doublet was a rich pearl gray, his fingers glittered with rings, and a heavy gold chain with a large pendant sapphire hung about his neck. "That's all right, gentlemen," he said to Geryon and Count Valgon with an airy wave of his hand. "You needn't rise." He extended his arm grandly to Tenedra, and the two of them came down the broad, carpeted aisle past the three glowing fire pits in the floor. "Silk!" Geryon exclaimed. "Ah, the very same," Silk replied, with a mocking little bow. "Your Majesty is looking well, considering." "Considering what?" Silk winked at him. "I am quite overwhelmed to meet so famous a merchant prince again," Valgon murmured politely. "Your Highness has become a legend in recent years. Your exploits in the East are the absolute despair of the great commercial houses in Torhaneth." "One has had certain modest success," Silk responded, breathing on a large ruby ring on his left hand, and then polishing it on the front of his doublet.
"In your next report, please convey my regards to your new emperor. His handling of the Vordu situation was masterly."
Valgon permitted himself a faint smile.
"I'm sure His Imperial Majesty will appreciate your good opinion, Prince Keldar."
He turned to Geryon.
"I know that your Majesty and his old friend will have many things to discuss," he said. "We can take up this other matter at a later date, perhaps," he bowed. "With your Majesty's permission, I will withdraw."
"Of course, Valgon," Geryon replied, "and thank you." The Tol'Nedron bowed again and quietly left the throne room. Tenedra came down to the foot of the throne and linked her arm affectionately with Silk's.
"I hope she didn't mind being interrupted, Geryon. I know that you and Valgon were having an absolutely fascinating talk."
Geryon made a face. "What was the idea behind all that formality?" he asked curiously. "The business with all those titles, I mean." Silk grinned.
"Oh, that was Senedra's idea. She felt that if we overwhelmed Valgon with enough titles, we could persuade him to go away. Did we interrupt anything important?"
Geryon gave him a sour look. He was talking about the problem of getting Tol'Nedron merchant vessels unloaded. I think that if he'd thrown the word prioritizing at me about one more time, I'd have jumped up and strangled him.
"No,"
Tenedra said, all wide-eyed and girlish.
"Let's call him back, then."
"I take it that you are, unfond of him?" Silk suggested.
"He's a Honathite,"
Tenedra replied, making an indelicate little sound.
"I despise the Honath."
"Let's go someplace else where we can talk," Geryon said, looking around at the formal throne room.
"Whatever your Majesty wishes," Silk said with a grand bow.
"Oh, stop that," Geryon said, coming down from the dais and leading the way toward the side door. When they reached the quiet, sunlit sanctuary of the royal apartment, Geryon sighed with relief as he took off his crown and shrugged out of his formal state robes.
"Ah, you have no idea how hot that thing gets," he said, tossing the robe in a heap on a chair in the corner.
"It also wrinkles, dear,"
Tenedra reminded him. She picked up the robe, folding it carefully, and hung it over the back of the chair.
"Perhaps I could find one for you in Melorian satin. A suitable collar, interwoven with silver thread," Silk suggested. "It would look very rich, tastefully understated, and not nearly so heavy."
"That's a thought," Geryon said.
"And I am sure that I could offer it to you at a very attractive price."
Geryon gave him a startled look, and Silk laughed.
"You never change, do you, Silk?"
Tenedra said.
"Oh, of course not,"
the little thief replied, sprawling unasked into a chair.
"What brings you to Riva?"
Geryon asked him, taking a chair across the table from his friend.
"Affection. At least mostly. I haven't seen you two for several years now. I don't suppose you've got anything to drink, handy?"
"We could probably find something," Geryon grinned at him.
"We have a rather pleasant little wine,"
Tenedra offered, going to a dark, polished sideboard.
"We have been trying to keep Geryon here away from the ale."
One of Silk's eyebrows went up.
"He has an unfortunate tendency to want to sing when he drinks ale. I wouldn't really want to put you through that."
"All right," Geryon said to her.
"It's not so much his voice,"
Tenedra went on relentlessly.
"It's the way he goes looking for the right notes, and he doesn't find them."
"Do you mind?" Geryon asked her. She laughed a shimmering little laugh and filled the two silver goblets with a blood-red Tol'Nedron wine.
"Aren't you joining us?"
Silk asked. She made a face.
"The heir to the Raven Throne doesn't care much for wine,"
she replied, delicately placing one hand on her swelling abdomen.
"Well, perhaps he enjoys it too much. He makes him start kicking, and I'd rather that he didn't break too many of my ribs."
"Ah," Silk said delicately.
She brought the goblets to the table and set them down.
Now, if you two gentlemen will excuse me, it's time for me to visit the baths.
Her hobby, Geryon said. She spends at least 2 hours of every afternoon down in the women's baths, even when she's not dirty. She shrugged.
It relaxes my back. I've been carrying this burden lately.
Once again, she touched her abdomen.
And it seems to get heavier every day.
I'm glad that it's the women who have the babies, Silk said. I'm sure I wouldn't really have the strength for it.
You're a nasty little man, Keldar,
she retorted tartly.
Oh, of course I am,
he smirked at her. She gave him a withering look and went in search of Lady Errol, her usual companion in the baths.
She looks absolutely blooming, Silk observed, and she's not nearly as bad-tempered as I had expected.
You should have been around a few months ago.
Bad?
Oh, you can't imagine.
It happens, I suppose. Or so I've been told.
What have you been up to lately? Geryon asked, leaning back in his chair. We haven't heard much about you.
Oh, I've been in Meloria, Silk replied, sipping at his wine. The fur trade isn't very challenging anymore, and Yarblek's been handling that end of the business. We felt that there was a great deal of money to be made in Melorian silks and carpets, and uncut gemstones, so I went over to investigate.
Isn't it a little dangerous for a Western merchant in Meloria?
No worse than in Rek'Goska, or Tor'Hanath for that matter. I've spent my whole life in dangerous places, Geryon.
Couldn't you just buy your goods at Yarmarak or Tolzelek when they come off of the Melorian ships?
The prices are better at the source. Every time an article goes through another pair of hands, the price doubles.
That makes sense, I suppose. Geryon looked at his friend, envying the freedom that made it possible for Silk to go anywhere in the world that he wanted to go.
What is Meloria really like?
We hear stories, but I think that's all they are most of the time.
Oh, it's in turmoil just now, Silk replied gravely. Kalzakaths are fighting his war with the Murgos, and the Grolums went all to pieces when they heard about the death of Torak. Melorian society has always been directed from either Melzeth or Meliaska, the Emperor or the Church. But now nobody seems to be in charge. The government bureaucracy tries to hold things together, but Melorians need strong leadership, and right now they don't have it. All sorts of strange things are beginning to surface. Rebellions, new religions, that kind of thing.
A thought occurred to Geryon. Have you run across the name Zandramas? Silk looked at him sharply.
It is odd that you should ask that. When I was in Boktor, just before Rodar died, I was talking with Javelin. Erend happened to be there, and he asked Javelin the same question. Javelin told him that it's a Darshivan name, and that was about all that he knew about it. When I went back to Meloria, I asked in a few places, but people got very tight-lipped and white-knuckled every time I mentioned it, so I let it drop. I gathered that it has something to do with one of those new religions I mentioned before.
Did you happen to hear anything about something called the Sardian? Or Thragsardius, maybe? Sulk frowned, tapping the rim of his goblet thoughtfully against his lower lip.
It's got a familiar ring to it. But I can't quite put my finger on where I heard it.
If you happen to remember, I would appreciate your telling me anything you can find out about it.
Is it important?
I think it might be. Grandfather and Belden have been trying to track it down.
I've got some contacts in Melzeth and Melsine. When I get back, I'll see what I can find out.
You're going back soon, then?
Silk nodded. I would have stayed there, but a little crisis came up in Yarnadrak. King Drosta started to get greedy.
We have been paying him some very healthy bribes to persuade him to look the other way about some of our activities in his kingdom. He got the notion that we were making a great deal of money, and he was toying with the idea of expropriating our holdings in Garognadrak. I had to come back and talk him out of the notion.
How did you manage that?
I've always had the impression that Drosta does pretty much what he wants in Garognadrak.
Oh, I threatened him.
I pointed out that I'm closely related to the King of Drasnia, and hinted that I was on very good terms with Kalzakath. The prospect of an invasion from either the east or the west didn't appeal to him, so he dropped the idea.
Are you on good terms with Sakath?
I've never met him, but Drosta doesn't know that.
You lied? Isn't that dangerous?
Lots of things are dangerous, Geryon. We have both been in tight spots before. Rakthal wasn't the safest place in the world, if you recall, and Tormishrak made me definitely edgy.
Geryon toyed with his goblet. You know something, Silk? I sort of miss all that.
All what?
Oh, I don't know. The danger, the excitement. Things have settled down pretty much for me. About the only excitement I get these days is in trying to maneuver my way around the Tolnedran ambassador. Oh, sometimes I just wish...
He left it hanging there.
Oh, you can come to Meloria with me if you would like, Silk offered. I could find interesting work for a man of your talents.
I don't think Tenedra would be too pleased if I left just now.
That's one of the reasons I never married, Silk told him. I don't have to worry about things like that.
Are you going to stop in Boktor on your way back?
Briefly, maybe. I visited the people I needed to see on my way here from Yarnadrak. Porin's doing very well with Keva. He's probably going to be a good king when he grows up. And I stopped by to see Javelin, of course. It's more or less expected. He likes to get our impressions of foreign countries, even when we are not acting in any official capacity.
Javelin's very good, isn't he?
He's the best.
I always thought you were.
Oh, not by a long way, Geryon, Silk smiled. I am too erratic. Brilliant, maybe, but erratic. I get sidetracked too easily. When Javelin goes after something, he doesn't let anything distract him until he gets it. Right now he's trying to get to the bottom of this bear cult thing.
Is he having any luck?
Not yet. He's been trying for several years to get somebody into the inner councils of the cult, but he has not been able to manage it. I told him that he ought to send in Hunter, but he told me that Hunter's busy with something else, and to mind my own business.
Hunter? Who's Hunter?
No, I have no idea, Silk admitted. It's not really a who, you see. It is a name that's applied to the most secret of our spies, and it changes from time to time. Only Javelin knows who Hunter is, and he won't tell anybody, not even Porin. Javelin himself was Hunter for a time, about 15 years ago. It's not always necessarily a Drasnian, though, or even a man. It can be anybody in the world. It might even be somebody we know. Barak, maybe, or Relg, or maybe somebody in Nyssa.
Mandarallan, perhaps?
Geryon suggested, smiling. Silk considered that.
No, Geryon. I don't think Mandarallan has the right equipment. It can surprise you, though. On several occasions, Hunter has even been a Murgo.
A Murgo? How could you possibly trust a Murgo?
Oh, I didn't say we always have to trust Hunter.
Geryon shook his head helplessly.
I'll never understand spies and spying.
No, it's a game, Silk told him.
And after you have played for a while, the game itself gets to be more important than which side you're on. Our reasons for doing things sometimes get pretty obscure.
I've noticed that, Geryon said. And as long as the subject has come up, what's your real reason for coming to Riva?
It's nothing all that secret, Geryon, Silk replied urbanely, adjusting the cuffs of his grey doublet. I realized a few years ago that a traveling merchant tends to lose track of things. If you want to stay on top of a local situation, you need to have an agent on the scene, somebody who can take advantage of opportunities when they arise. I have located some markets for certain Riven products, glass, good boots, those wool capes, that sort of thing, and I decided that it might not be a bad idea to have a representative there.
That's really a very good idea, Silk. Things are a little static down in the city. We could use some new businesses to liven things up.
Silk beamed at him.
And I can always use the additional revenue,
Geryon added.
What? There are a few taxes, Silk. Oh, nothing too burdensome, but I'm sure you understand. A kingdom is very expensive to run.
Geryon, Silk's voice was anguished.
Oh, it's one of the first things I learned. People don't mind taxes so much if they're sure that everybody's paying the same. I can't really make exceptions at all. Not even for an old friend. I'll introduce you to Kale. He's my chief administrator. He'll set things up for you.
I'm terribly disappointed in you, Geryon, Silk said with a crestfallen look.
As you've said so many times, business is business after all.
There was a light tap at the door.
Yes,
Geryon answered.
The Riven Warder, Your Majesty,
the sentry outside announced.
Send him in.
The tall, graying Riven Warder entered quietly.
Prince Kildare,
he greeted Silk with a brief nod, then turned toward Geryon.
I wouldn't bother Your Majesty,
he apologized.
I wouldn't bother you, but a matter of some urgency has come up.
Of course, Brand, Geryon replied politely. Please sit down.
Thank you, Belgerion,
Brand said gratefully, sinking into a chair.
My legs aren't what they used to be.
Isn't it a joy to grow older? Silk said. The mind gets better, but everything else starts to fall apart.
Brand smiled briefly.
There's been a bit of a squabble in the garrison here in the citadel, Belgerion,
he said, getting directly to the point.
I'll discipline the two young men involved myself. But I thought that perhaps if you spoke to them, it might head off bloodshed.
Bloodshed?
They were bickering over something quite unimportant. One thing led to another. They scuffled a bit and knocked a few of each other's teeth loose. That should have been the end of it. But they started issuing each other formal challenges. I was fairly sure that you would want to keep the swords out of it.
Definitely.
I can order them to withdraw the challenges, but there is always the possibility that they will sneak out some night and find a private place to do war on each other. I think that if the king spoke with them, we might be able to head off that sort of foolishness. They are a couple of fairly good young men. I don't think we want to have them chopping each other up into dog meat.
Geryon nodded his agreement.
Send the pair of them to me first thing in the...
The medallion he always wore gave a peculiar little twitch, and he broke off what he was saying, startled by the flutter against his chest. The amulet suddenly seemed to grow very hot, and there was a strange humming sound in his ears.
What is it, Geryon?
Silk asked him curiously. Geryon started to hold up one hand as he tried to pinpoint the source of the humming sound. Then his amulet gave a violent lurch that was almost like a blow to his chest. The humming shattered, and he heard Tenedra's voice crying to him,
"Geryon, help me! Help!"
He sprang to his feet as Brand and Silk stared at him in amazement.
"Tenedra," he shouted, "where are you?"
"Help me, Geryon, the baths!"
"Quick!" Geryon exclaimed to the others. "Tenedra needs us in the baths!"
And he ran from the room, grabbing up a plain sword standing sheathed in the corner as he passed.
"What is it?"
Silk demanded, running along behind as they burst into the outer corridor.
"I don't know," Geryon shouted. "She called me for help."
He shook his sword as he ran, trying to free it of its sheath. Something's happening down in the baths. It was a long way down seemingly endless flights of torchlit stairs to the baths and the cellars of the citadel. Geryon went down those stairs 3 and 4 at a time, with Silk and Brand hot on his heels. Startled servants and officials jumped out of their way as they rushed down, faces grim and with drawn weapons in their hands. At the bottom of the last flight of the stairs, they found the heavy door to the women's baths, bolted from the inside. Instantly summoning his will, Geryon focused it and commanded, "Burst!" The iron-bound door blasted inward, falling off of its hinges. The scene inside was one of horror. The Lady Arrow lay in a crumpled heap on the tile floor with a hilt of a dagger protruding from between her shoulders. In the center of the steaming pool, a tall, raw-boned woman in a dark cloak was grimly holding something under the water, something struggling weakly. Floating on the surface above that struggling form was a great fan of coppery red hair. "Tenedra!" Geryon shouted, leaping feet first into the pool with his sword aloft. The cloaked woman gave him one startled glance and fled, splashing frantically away from the enraged king. Tenedra's tiny body rose limply to the surface of the pool, and she floated face down, bobbing slightly in the water. With a cry of anguish, Geryon dropped his sword and struggled through the warm, waist-deep water, his desperate arms reaching out toward the limp body floating just beyond his grasp. Roaring with rage, Brand ran around the tiled walkway surrounding the pool with his sword aloft, pursuing the tall woman who was fleeing through a narrow doorway on the far side of the bath. But Silk was already ahead of him, running swiftly after the woman with a long-bladed dagger held low. Geryon caught up the body of his wife in his arms and struggled toward the edge of the pool. With horror, he realized she was not breathing. "What can I do?" he cried desperately. "Aunt Paul, what can I do?" But Aunt Paul was not there. He laid Tenedra on the tiles on the edge of the pool. There was no sign of movement, no flutter of breath, and her face was a ghastly blue-gray color. "Somebody help me!" Geryon cried out, catching the tiny lifeless form in his arms and holding it very close to him. Something throbbed sharply against his chest, and he looked into his wife's still face, desperately searching for some sign of life. But Tenedra did not move, and her little body was limp. Again he caught her to him. Once again he felt that sharp throb, almost like a blow against his heart. He held Tenedra away from him again, searching with tear-filled eyes for the source of that strange, jolting throb. The flickering light of one of the torches stuck in iron rings around the marble walls of the pool seemed to dance on the polished surface of the silver amulet at her throat. Could it have been? With a trembling hand, he put his fingertips to the amulet. He felt a tingling shock in his fingers. Startled, he jerked his hand away. Then he closed his fist about the amulet. He could feel it in his palm, throbbing like a silver heart beating with a faltering rhythm. "Tenedra," he said sharply. "You've got to wake up. Please don't die, Tenedra." But there was no sign, no movement from his wife. Still holding the amulet, Geryon began to weep. "Aunt Paul," he cried brokenly, "what can I do?" "Geryon?" It was Aunt Paul's startled voice, coming to him across the empty miles. "Aunt Paul, help me!" "What is it? What is wrong?" "It's Tenedra. She's been drowned." And the full horror of it struck him like some great overwhelming blow, and he began to sob again, great tearing sobs. "Oh, stop that!" Aunt Paul's voice cracked like a whip. "Where?" she demanded. "When did this happen?"
"Here, in the baths. She's not breathing, Aunt Paul. I think she's dead."
"Stop babbling, Geryon." Her voice was like a slap in the face. "How long has it been since her breathing stopped?"
"A few minutes. I don't know."
"You don't have any time to lose. Have you got her out of the water?"
"Yes, but she's not breathing, and her face is like ashes."
"Listen carefully. You have got to force the water out of her lungs. Put her down on her face and push on her back. Try to do it in the same rhythm as normal breathing.
and be careful not to push too hard. You don't want to hurt the baby.
But do as I say, Geryon.
He turned his silent wife over and began to carefully push down on her ribs. An astonishing amount of water came out of the tiny girl's mouth, but she remained still and unmoving. Geryon stopped and took hold of the amulet again.
Nothing's happening, Aunt Paul.
Don't stop.
He began pushing on Tenedra's ribs again. He was about ready to despair, but then she coughed, and he almost wept with relief. He continued to push at her back. She coughed again, and then she began to cry weakly. Geryon put his hand on the amulet.
She's crying, Aunt Paul. She's alive.
Good. You can stop now.
What happened? Some woman tried to kill her here in the baths. Silk and Brand are chasing the woman now.
There was a long silence.
I see, Aunt Paul said finally. Now, listen, Geryon, carefully. Tenedra's lungs will be very weak after this. The main danger right now is congestion and fever. You have got to keep her warm and quiet. Her life and the baby's depend upon that. As soon as her breathing is stronger, get her to bed. I will be there as soon as I can.
Geryon moved quickly, gathering up every towel and robe that he could find to make a bed for his weakly crying wife. As he covered her with his cloak, Silk returned, his face grim, and Brand, puffing noticeably, was right behind him.
"Is she all right?"
the big warder asked, his face desperately concerned.
"I think so," Geryon said. "I got her breathing started again. Did that woman get away?"
"Not exactly," Silk replied. "She ran upstairs until she reached the battlements. When she got up there, I was right behind her. She saw that there was no way to escape, so she threw herself off."
Geryon felt a surge of satisfaction at that.
"Good," he said without thinking. "No, not really. We needed to question her. Now we will never find out who sent her here to do this." "I hadn't thought of that."
Brand had gone sadly to the silent body of his niece.
"My poor Errol," he said, his voice full of tears.
He knelt beside her and took hold of the dagger protruding from her back.
"Even in death, she served her queen," he said almost proudly.
Geryon looked at him.
"The dagger stuck," Brand explained, tugging at it. "The woman who killed her couldn't get it out. That's why she was trying to drown Tenedra. If she had been able to use this knife, we'd have been too late."
"I'm going to find out who's responsible for this," Geryon declared from between clenched teeth. "I think I'll have him flayed."
"Oh, flaying is good," Silk agreed. "Or boiling. Boiling has always been my favorite."
"Geryon,"
Tenedra said weakly, and all thoughts of vengeance fled from Geryon's mind as he turned toward her. While he held his wife close to him, he dimly heard Silk speaking quietly to Brand.
"After somebody picks up what is left of our would-be assassin, I'd like to have all of her clothing brought to me."
"Her clothing?"
"Right. The woman is not able to talk anymore, but her clothing might. You would be surprised at how much you can learn about someone by looking at his undergarments. We want to find out who was behind this, and that dead woman out there is our only clue. I want to know who she was and where she came from. The quicker I can do that, the quicker we can start heating up the oil."
"Oil?"
"I'm going to simmer the man who was behind this. Slowly, and with a great deal of attention to every exquisite detail."
Chapter 14. Polgara arrived late that same afternoon. No one saw fit to raise the question of how she had crossed the hundreds of intervening leagues in the space of hours instead of weeks. the sentry who had been standing watch atop the battlements and who escorted her to the sick room, however, had a slightly wild look in his eyes, as if he had just seen something about which he would prefer not to speak. Geryon, at the moment she arrived, was in the midst of a discussion with one of the court physicians about the therapeutic value of bleeding, and the conversation had reached the point where he had just picked up a sword to confront the startled medical man who was approaching the bed with a lancet in hand. "If you try to open my wife's veins with that," the young king declared firmly, "I'm going to open yours with this." "All right," Polgara said crisply. "That will do, Geryon." She removed her cloak and laid it across the back of a chair. "Aunt Paul," he gasped with relief. She had already turned to face the four physicians who had been tending to the little queen. "Thank you for your efforts, gentlemen. I'll send for you if I need you." The note of dismissal in her voice was final, and the four quietly filed out.
"Lady Polgara?"
Cinedra said weakly from the bed. Polgara turned to her immediately. "Yes, dear," she said, taking Cinedra's tiny hand in hers. "How do you feel?"
"My chest hurts, and I can't seem to stay awake."
"We'll have you up and about in no time at all, dear," Polgara assured her. She looked critically at the bed. "I think I'm going to need more pillows, Geryon. I want to prop her up into a sitting position." Geryon quickly went through the sitting room to the door leading to the corridor outside.
"Yes, Your Majesty," the sentry said as Geryon opened the door.
"Do you want to get me about a dozen or so pillows?"
"Of course, Your Majesty."
The sentry started down the corridor. "On second thought, make that 2 dozen, Geryon called after him. Then he went back to the bedroom.
"I mean it, Lady Polgara,"
Cinedra was saying in a weak little voice.
"If it ever gets to the point where you have to make a choice, save my baby. Don't even think about me."
"I see," Polgara replied gravely. "I hope you have purged yourself of that particular nonsense now." Cinedra stared at her. "Melodrama has always made me just ever so faintly nauseous." A slow flush crept up Cinedra's cheeks. "Oh, that's a very good sign," Aunt Paul encouraged her. "If you can blush, it means that you're well enough to take final note of trivial things."
"Trivial?"
"Such as being embarrassed about how truly stupid that last statement of yours really was. Your baby's fine, Cinedra. In fact, he's better off right now than you are. He's sleeping at the moment." Sinedra's eyes had gone wide, and her hands were placed protectively over her abdomen.
"You can see him?"
she asked incredulously. "See is not exactly the right word, dear," Polgara said as she mixed 2 powders together in a glass. "I know what he's doing, and what he's thinking about." She added water to the mixture in the glass and watched critically as the contents bubbled and fumed. "Here," she instructed, handing the glass to her patient, "drink this." Then she turned to Geryon. "Build up the fire, dear. It's autumn, after all. We don't want her getting chilled." Brand and Silk had rather carefully examined the broken body of the would-be assassin, and had shifted their attention to her clothing by the time Geryon joined them late that evening. "Have you found out anything yet?" he asked as he entered the room.
"We know that she was an Aelon,"
Brand replied in his rumbling voice.
"About 35 years old. She did not work for a living. At least she didn't do anything that strenuous, not enough to put calluses on her hands."
"Well, that's not very much to go on."
"It is a start,"
Silk told him, carefully examining the hem of a blood-stained dress. "It sort of points at the bear cult, then, doesn't it?"
"Not necessarily,"
Silk replied, laying aside the dress and picking up a linen shift.
"When you're trying to hide your identity, you pick an assassin from another country. Of course, that kind of thinking might be a little too subtle for the bear cult."
He frowned then.
"Now, where have I seen this stitch before?" he muttered, still looking at the dead woman's undergarment.
"I'm so very sorry about Errol," Geryon said to Brand. "We were all very fond of her." It seemed like such an inadequate thing to say.
"She would have appreciated that, Belgerion,"
Brand said quietly.
"She loved Synhedra very much."
Geryon turned back to Silk with a feeling of frustration boiling in him. "What are we going to do?" he demanded. "If we can't find out who was behind this, he'll probably just try again."
"I certainly hope so," Silk said.
"You what?"
"We can save a lot of time if we can catch somebody who is still alive. You can only get so much out of dead people." "I wish we'd been a little more thorough when we wiped out the bear cult at Tul Mardu,"
Brand added.
"I would not get my mind too set on the notion that the bear cult was responsible for this," Silk told them.
"There are some other possibilities." "Who else would want to hurt Synhedra?" Geryon asked. Silk sprawled in a chair, scratching absently at his cheek, with his forehead furrowed in thought.
"Maybe it was not Synhedra," he mused.
"What?"
"It is altogether possible, you know, that the attempt was directed at the baby that she's carrying. There could be people out there in the world who do not want there to be an heir to Iron Grip's throne."
"Who?"
"The Grolums come to mind rather quickly," Silk replied. "Or the Nissans, even a few Tonedrans. I want to keep an open mind on the matter until I find out a few more things." He held up the stained undergarment. "I am going to start with this. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to take it down to the city and show it to every tailor and seamstress that I can find. I might be able to get something out of the weave, and there's a peculiar kind of stitching along the hem. If I can find somebody to identify it for me, it might give us something to work on."
Brand looked thoughtfully over at the still blanket-draped form of the woman who had tried to kill Synhedra.
"She would have had to have entered the citadel by way of one of the gates. That means that she passed a sentry, and that she had to have given him some kind of excuse for coming in. I'll round up every man who's been on sentry duty for the past week. We'll bring them all down here to have a look at her. Once we know exactly when she got in, maybe we can start to backtrack her. I'd like to find the ship she arrived on and have a talk with the captain."
"What can I do?" Geryon asked quickly.
"Probably you should stay close to Tenedra's room," Silk suggested. "Anytime Palgra leaves for any reason at all, you ought to go in and take her place. There could be other attempts, you know. And I think we all feel better if Synhedra is guarded rather closely."
Under Palgra's watchful eyes, Synhedra spent a quiet night, and her breathing was much stronger the next day. She complained bitterly about the taste of the medicines she was required to drink, and Palgra listened with a great show of interest to the queen's extensive tirade.
"Yes, dear,"
she agreed pleasantly. "Now, drink it all down."
"Does it have to taste so awful?"
Synhedra said with a shudder. "Of course it does. If medicine tasted good, sick people might be tempted to stay sick so that they could enjoy the medicine. The worse it tastes, the quicker you will get well."
Late that afternoon, Silk returned with a disgusted look on his face. "I had not realized how many ways it is possible to attach two pieces of cloth together," he grumbled.
"No luck, then, I take it?"
"Not really," Silk replied, throwing himself into a chair. "I managed to pick up all sorts of educated guesses, though."
"Oh?"
"One tailor was willing to stake his reputation on the fact that this particular stitch is used exclusively in Nyssa. Another seamstress told me very confidently that this was an Ulgo garment, and one half-wit went so far as to say that the owner of the garment was a sailor, since this stitch is always used to repair torn sails."
"What are you talking about, Silk?" Palgra asked curiously, as she passed through the sitting room on her way back to Tenedra's bedside.
"I have been trying to get someone to identify the stitching on the hem of this thing,"
he said in disgusted tones, waving the blood-stained shift. "Here, let me see it." Silk wordlessly handed her the garment. She glanced at it almost casually. "Northeastern Dresnia," she told him. "From somewhere near the town of Vreon."
"Are you sure?"
Silk came quickly to his feet. She nodded. That kind of stitching was developed centuries ago, back in the days when all of the garments up there were made from reindeer skins.
"But that is disgusting," Silk said.
"What is?"
"I ran around all day long with this thing, up and down all of those stairs and in front of every tailor shop in Riva, and all I had to do to find out what I wanted to know was to show it to you."
"But that's not my fault, Prince Skeldar," she told him, handing him back the shift. "If you don't know enough to bring these little problems to me by now, then there probably isn't much hope for you."
"Oh, thank you, Polgara," he said dryly.
"Then the assassin was a Dresnian."
"A northeastern Dresnian," Silk corrected. "Those people up there are a strange sort, almost worse than the ones who live in the Finns."
"Strange?"
"Standoffish, closed-mouthed, unfriendly, clannish, secretive. Everybody in northeast Dresnia behaves as if he had all the state secrets in the kingdom tucked up his sleeve."
"Why would they hate Tenedra so much?"
Geryon asked with a puzzled frown.
"I wouldn't make too much of the fact that this assassin was a Dresnian, Geryon. People who hire other people to do their killing for them don't always go looking for their hirelings close to home. And although there are a lot of assassins in the world, very few of them are women." He pursed his lips thoughtfully.
"I do think that I'll take a trip up to Rayon and have a look around, however."
As the chill of winter set in, Polgara finally declared that Tenedra was out of all danger.
"I think I will stay, though," she added. "Durnick and Erend can manage at home for a few months, and I'd probably no sooner get home than I'd have to turn around and come back."
Geryon looked at her blankly.
"You didn't actually think that I was going to let anybody else deliver Tenedra's first baby, did you?"
It snowed heavily just before Eris died, and the steep streets of the city of Riva became virtually impassable. Tenedra's disposition soured noticeably. Her increasing girth made her awkward, and the depth of the snow in the city streets had rather effectively confined her to the citadel. Polgara took the little queen's outbursts and crying fits calmly, scarcely changing expression even at the height of the eruptions.
"You do want to have this baby, don't you?" she asked pointedly on one such occasion.
"Of course I do,"
Tenedra replied indignantly. "Well, then, you have to go through this. It is the only way I know of to fill the nursery."
"Don't try to be reasonable with me, Lady Polgara,"
Tenedra flared.
"I am not in the mood for this reasonableness right now."
Polgara gave her a faintly amused look, and Tenedra, in spite of herself, began to laugh.
"I am being silly, aren't I?"
"A bit, yes."
"It's just that I feel so huge and ugly."
"That will pass, Tenedra."
"Sometimes I wish I could just lay eggs the way birds do."
"I would stick to doing it the old way, dear. I don't think you have the disposition for sitting on a nest."
Aristide came and passed quietly. The celebration on the island was warm, but somewhat restrained. It seemed as if the whole population was holding its breath, waiting for a much larger reason for celebration. Winter ground on, with each week adding more snow to the already high-piled drifts. A month or so after Aristide, there was a brief thaw, lasting for perhaps 2 days, and then the frigid chill locked in again, turning the sodden snowbanks into blocks of ice. The weeks plodded by tediously, and everybody waited.
"Would you just look at that?"
Tenedra said angrily to Geryon one morning, shortly after they had risen.
"At what, dear?"
he replied mildly.
"At that!"
She pointed disgustedly at the window.
"It is snowing again!"
He heard a note of accusation in her voice. "It's not my fault," he said defensively.
Did I say that it was?
She turned awkwardly to glare at him. Her tininess made her swollen belly appear all the larger, and she sometimes seemed to thrust it out at him as if it were entirely his doing.
This is just absolutely insupportable, she declared. Why have you brought me to this frozen...
She stopped in mid-tirade, a strange look crossing her face. Are you all right, dear?
Don't dear me, Garion, I...
She stopped again.
Oh, my,
she said breathlessly. What is it? He got to his feet.
Oh, dear,
Tinedra said, putting her hands to the small of her back.
Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear.
Tinedra, that's not very helpful. What's the matter?
I think perhaps I'd better go lie down,
she said almost absently. She started across the room, moving at a stately waddle. She stopped.
Oh, dear,
she said with much more vehemence. Her face was pale, and she put one hand on a chair back to support herself.
I think that it might be a good idea if you sent for Lady Polgara, Garion.
Is it... I mean, are you...
Don't babble, Garion. Just open the door and scream for your Aunt Paul.
Are you trying to say that...
I'm not trying, Garion. I am saying it. Get her in here right now.
She waddled to the bedroom door and stopped again with a little gasp.
Oh, my goodness.
Garion stumbled to the door and jerked it open. Get Lady Polgara, he said to the startled sentry. Immediately, run.
Yes, your majesty, the man replied, dropping his spear and sprinting down the hall.
Garion slammed the door and dashed to Tenedra's side.
"Can I do anything?" he asked, wringing his hands.
"Help me to bed."
"Bed? Right."
He grabbed her arm and began to tug at her.
"What are you doing?"
"Bed," he blurted, pointing at the royal four-poster.
"I know what it is, Garion. Help me. Don't yank on me."
"Oh," he took her hand, slipped his other arm about her, and lifted her off of her feet. He stumbled toward the bed, his eyes wide and his mind completely blank.
"Put me down, you great oaf!"
"Bed,"
he urged her, trying with all of the eloquence at his command to explain. He carefully set her back down on her feet and rushed on ahead.
"Nice bed," he said, patting the coverlets encouragingly.
Tinedra closed her eyes and sighed.
"Just step out of the way, Garion,"
she said with resignation.
"But..."
"Why don't you build up the fire?"
she suggested.
"What?"
He stared around blankly.
"The fireplace? That opening in the wall with the burning logs in it? Put some more wood in there. We want it nice and warm for the baby, don't we?"
She reached the bed and leaned against it. Garion dashed to the fireplace and stood staring at it stupidly.
"What's the matter now?"
"Wood," he replied. "No wood."
"Bring some in from the other room."
What an absolutely brilliant suggestion she had just made. He stared at her gratefully.
"Go into the other room, Garion,"
she said, speaking very slowly and distinctly.
"Pick up some wood, carry it back in here. Put it on the fire. Have you got all of that so far?"
"Right,"
he said excitedly. He dashed into the other room, picked up a stick of firewood, and dashed back in with it.
"Wood,"
he said, holding the stick up proudly.
"Very nice, Garion,"
she said, climbing laboriously into the bed.
"Now, put it on the fire, and go back out and bring in some more."
"More,"
he agreed, flinging the stick into the fireplace and dashing out the door again. After he had emptied the wood bin in the sitting room, one stick at a time, he stared around wildly, trying to decide what to do next. He picked up a chair. If he were to swing it against the wall, he reasoned, it ought to break up into manageable pieces. The door to the apartment opened and Polgara came in. She stopped to stare at the wild-eyed Garion.
"What on earth are you doing with that chair?"
"Wood," he explained, brandishing the heavy piece of furniture.
"Need wood for the fire."
She gave him a long look, smoothing down the front of her white apron.
"I see,"
It's going to be one of those. Put the chair down, Geryon. Where is Synedra?
Bed, he replied, regretfully setting down the polished chair. Then he looked at her brightly.
Baby,
he informed her. She rolled her eyes toward the ceiling. Geryon, she said, speaking carefully as if to a child, it is much too early for Synedra to be taken to her bed. She needs to walk around, keep moving. He shook his head stubbornly.
Bed, he repeated. Baby.
He looked around and picked up the chair again. Polgara sighed, opened the door, and beckoned to the sentry.
Young man, why don't you take His Majesty here down to the courtyard just outside the kitchen? There's a large pile of logs there. Get him an axe so that he can cut up some more firewood.
Everybody was being absolutely brilliant today. Geryon marveled at the suggestion Aunt Paul had just made. He set down the chair again and dashed out with the baffled sentry in tow. He chopped up what seemed like a cord of wood in the first hour, sending out a positive blizzard of chips as he swung the axe so fast that it seemed almost to blur in the air. Then he paused, pulled off his doublet, and really got down to work. About noon, a respectful cook brought him a slab of freshly roasted beef, a large chunk of bread, and some ale. Geryon wolfed down three or four bites, took a couple of gulps of the ale, then picked up his axe to attack another log. It was altogether possible that he might have finished up with the woodpile outside of the kitchen, and then gone in search of more trees had not Brand interrupted him shortly before the sun went down. The big gray-haired warder had a broad grin on his face.
"Congratulations, Belgerian. You have a son."
Geryon paused, looking almost regretfully at the remaining logs. Then what Brand had just said finally seeped into his awareness. The axe slid from his fingers.
"A son?" he said. "What an amazing thing. So quickly, too."
He looked at the woodpile.
"I only just now got here. I always thought that it took much longer."
Brand looked at him carefully, then gently took him by the arm.
"Come along now, Belgerian. Let's go up and meet your son."
Geryon bent and picked up an armload of wood.
"For the fire," he explained. "Synedra wants a nice big fire."
"She will be very proud of you, Belgerian,"
Brand assured him. When they reached the royal bedchamber, Geryon carefully put his armload of wood on the polished table by the window and approached the bed on tiptoe. Synedra looked very tired and wan, but there was, nonetheless, a contented little smile on her face. Nestled beside her in a soft blanket was a very small person. The newcomer had a red face and almost no hair. He seemed to be asleep. But as Geryon approached, his eyes opened. Gravely, the crown prince looked at his father, then sighed, burped, and went back to sleep.
"Oh, isn't he just beautiful, Geryon?"
Synedra said in a wondering little voice.
"Yes,"
Geryon replied with a great lump coming up into his throat.
"And so are you."
He knelt beside the bed and put his arms about both of them.
"Very nice, children,"
Polgara said from the other side of the bed.
"You both did just fine."
The following day, Geryon and his newborn son went through a very ancient ceremony. With Polgara at his side in a splendid blue and silver gown, he carried the baby to the hall of the Riven King, where the nobles of the island kingdom awaited them. As the three of them entered the hall, the orb of Aldur standing on the pommel of Iron Grip's sword blazed forth with a great shimmer of blue light. Almost bemused, Geryon approached his throne.
"This is my son Geryon,"
he announced, in part to the gathered throng, but also in a peculiar way to the orb itself. The choice of his son's name had not been difficult. Though he could not remember his father, Geryon had wanted to honor him. And no way seemed more appropriate than to give his son his own father's name. He carefully handed the baby to Polgara,
reached up and took down the great sword. Holding it by the blade, he extended it toward the blanket-wrapped infant in Polgara's arms. The shimmering glow of the orb grew brighter. And then, as if attracted by the light, Garen stretched forth his tiny pink hand and put it on the glowing jewel. A great aura of many-colored light burst from the orb at the infant's touch, surrounding the three of them with a pulsating rainbow that illuminated the entire hall. A vast chorus filled Garion's ears, rising to an enormous chord that seemed to shake the whole world.
"Hail, Garen!" Brand boomed in a great voice. "Heir to the throne of Iron Grip, and keeper of the Orb of Aldor!"
"Hail, Garen!" the throng echoed in a thunderous shout.
"Hail, Garen!"
the dry voice in Garion's mind added quietly. Polgara said nothing. She did not need to speak, since the look in her eyes said everything that needed saying. Although it was winter, and the Sea of the Winds was lashed by storms, the Elorn kings all journeyed to Riva to celebrate the birth of Garen. Many others, friends and old acquaintances, joined with Anheg, Kohag, and Queen Poran on their journey to Riva. Barak was there, of course, accompanied by his wife Meryl. Hetar and Adara arrived. Leldoran and Mandoralan came up from Arindia with Arianna and Nerina. Garion, now somewhat more sensitive to such things, was amazed at how many children his friends had produced. No matter which way he turned, there seemed to be babies and the sound of little boys and girls running and laughing filling the sober halls of the citadel. The boy King Kiva of Dresnia and Barak's son Unrak soon became the closest of friends. Narina's daughters romped with Adara's sons in endless games involving much giggling. Barak's eldest daughter, Gundrid, now a ravishing young lady, cut a broad track through the hearts of whole platoons of young Riven nobles, all the while under the watchful eye of her huge red-bearded father, who never actually threatened any of his daughter's suitors, but whose looks said quite plainly that he would tolerate no foolishness. Little Terzi, Gundrid's younger sister, hovered on the very brink of womanhood, romping one moment with the younger children, and looking the next with devastating eyes at the group of adolescent Riven boys who always seemed to be around. King Folrak and General Brendig sailed over from Sindaria about midway through the celebration. Queen Layla sent her fondest congratulations, but she did not make the trip with her husband.
"She's almost got on board the ship," Folrak reported. "But then a gust of wind made a wave break over the stones of the quay, and she fainted. We decided not to subject her to the voyage at that point."
"It's probably best," Garion agreed.
Durnik and Erend came up from the Vale, naturally, and with them came Belgarath. The celebration went on for weeks. There were banquets and formal presentations of gifts, both by the visitors and by the ambassadors of various friendly kingdoms. And, of course, there were hours of reminiscences and a fair amount of serious drinking. Zinedra was in her glory, since she and her infant son were the absolute center of attention. Garion found that the festivities, coupled with his normal duties, left him almost no free time at all. He wished that he could find an hour or two to talk with Barak, Hetar, Mandoralan, and Leldoran, but no matter how he tried to rearrange his days, the time simply was not there. Very late one evening, however, Belgarath came looking for him. Garion looked up from a report he had been reading as the old sorcerer entered his study.
"I thought we might talk for a little bit," the old man said.
Garion tossed aside the report. "I haven't meant to neglect you, grandfather, but they are keeping my days pretty well filled up."
Belgarath shrugged. "Things are bound to settle down in a while. Did I ever get around to congratulating you?"
"I think so."
"Good. That's taken care of then. People always make such a fuss about babies. I don't really care that much for them myself. They're all squally and wet most of the time. It's almost impossible to talk to them. You don't mind if I help myself, do you?"
He pointed at a crystal decanter of pale wine standing on a table.
No, go ahead.
You want some?
No thanks, Grandfather.
Belgarath poured himself a goblet of wine and then settled down in a chair across from Geryon's.
How's the king business?
Tedious,
Geryon replied ruefully. Actually, that's not a bad thing, you know. When it gets exciting, that usually means that something pretty awful is happening.
I suppose you're right.
Have you been studying?
Geryon sat up quickly. I'm glad you brought that up. Things have been so hectic that something sort of important had almost slipped my mind.
Oh?
How careful were people when they made copies of those prophecies?
Belgarath shrugged. Fairly careful, I suppose. Why do you ask?
I think that something got left out of my copy of the Mrin Codex.
What makes you think so?
There's a passage in there that just doesn't make any sense.
Maybe not to you, but you haven't been studying all that long.
That's not what I mean, Grandfather. I'm not talking about an obscure meaning. When I'm getting at this, it's a sentence that starts out and then just stops without going anywhere. I mean, it doesn't have any ending. Not the way it should.
You are concerned about grammar?
Geryon scratched at his head.
It's the only passage I found in there that breaks off that way. It goes, "But behold, the stone which lies at the center of the light shall..." And then there's a blot, and then it takes up again with, "This meeting will come to pass in a place which is no more, and there the choice will be made."
Belgarath frowned. "I think I know the passage."
"The two just don't fit together, Grandfather. The first part is talking about the orb, at least that's the way I read it, and the second part is talking about a meeting. I don't know what word is under that blot, but I can't for the life of me figure out how the two parts could be hooked together. I think there's something missing. That's why I was asking about how they went about copying these things. Could the scribe who was doing it have skipped a couple of lines?"
"I don't think so, Geryon. The new copy is always compared with the old one by somebody other than the scribe. We are fairly careful about things like that."
"Well, then what's under that blot?"
Belgarath scratched his beard thoughtfully.
"I can't quite recall," he admitted. "Anheg's here. Maybe he remembers. Or you can ask him to transcribe that part from his copy and send it to you when he gets back to Val'Alon."
"Well, that's a good idea."
"I wouldn't worry too much about it, Geryon. It is only part of one passage, after all."
"There are a lot of things in there that are only one passage, Grandfather, and they turned out to be sort of important."
Well, if it bothers you so much, chase it down. It's a good way to learn."
"Aren't you the least bit curious about it?"
"I have other things on my mind. You're the one who found the discrepancy. So I will give you all of the glory of exposing it to the world and working out the solution."
"You're not being very much help, Grandfather."
Belgarath grinned at him.
"I'm not really trying to be, Geryon. You are grown up enough now to solve your own problems."
He looked over at the decanter.
"I believe I'll have just another little touch of that," he said.